Case number 075299, Devon Energy Corporation Appellant versus Dirk Kempthorne, Secretary of the Interior. Ms. Haglund for the appellant, Mr. Sankar for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Deborah Haglund, and I'm representing Devon Energy Company, and with me this morning is Charles Tetrault. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal involves a final decision by the Interior Department, a decision that requires Devon to retroactively recalculate federal royalties on coal bed methane produced in Wyoming based on a methodology that's inconsistent, in fact, directly opposed to the methodology that Devon was instructed to use by the agency at the time the royalties were paid.
Not inconsistent with the underlying regulation, though, right?
The decision, yes, we believe it is inconsistent with the underlying
regulation. Well, I thought you were challenging based on the advisories, not on the regulation. There is a regulation. The agency argues that their final action in this case is consistent in its interpretation of the regulation. It's a viable interpretation of the regulation to
Correct.
Which we should defer.
Correct, Your Honor. And we argue that the interpretation of the regulation in the decision shouldn't be deferred to for two reasons. First is because we believe it is inconsistent with the language of the regulation itself. And second, we believe that it is inconsistent with the agency's prior interpretation of the regulation.
Prior interpretation of the regulation?
Correct, Your Honor. The 1995...
Oh, you mean you're talking about the advisories, the guidelines, whatever?
Correct, Your Honor. So we're saying not only is the decision inconsistent with the language of the regulation, we're also saying it's inconsistent with the agency's prior interpretation of the regulation.
All right, so tell me, what is your principal argument in this case? That is that the regulation is what's at issue, and their interpretation of the regulation cannot stand. It just doesn't make any sense. Or the guidelines created a new regulatory regime, and we're resting on that.
Well, we are arguing both, Your Honor.
Well, what do you say is your first and principal argument?
Our first and principal argument is that the interpretation can't stand because it's inconsistent with the plain language of the regulation itself, not just the interpretation, but the regulation itself. We have a regulation marketable.
Do you think the regulation is rather ambiguous, counsel? I know on the one hand it says transportation costs can be deducted. On the other hand, it says costs to put it in marketable condition cannot, and it almost takes a Talmudic scholar to try to figure out where you draw the line between the two.
Understand, the cases are very confusing, but the transportation allowance regulations address a different issue than is addressed by the marketable condition rule. Transportation allowance regulations address the question of who bears the cost of conditioning gas so that it can be delivered to a downstream purchaser. That's the transportation allowance regulations. They address the cost of delivering gas to a purchaser. The marketable condition rule, on the other hand, addresses the question of the condition gas has to be in to be accepted by a purchaser under a sales contract So on the one hand, you have what does it take to deliver gas to a purchaser?
Yes, but sometimes delivering and marketable condition overlap, don't they?
That is true. And what the regulations say in that circumstance is that the marketable condition rule controls. So,
well, that's the agency's position.
Well, but the agency's position in this case is that the marketable condition rule applies for the same reason that the transportation rules apply, and that is
one of the things that confused me, counsel, is what is the area that we're talking about here
in terms of the field or area?
Yes, field or area.
Well, there are three fields in the Powder River Basin, and probably the Powder River Basin would be the area that we're talking about.
Probably. Now, what do you say to the government's position that you did not produce any evidence as to what the price of gas was in the field?
Well, I would say, first of all, that at the time we requested a value determination, we were assuming that the agency's prior instructions controlled, which is that you have to condition gas to meet the requirements at the royalty measurement point in the field when it
did you ask for a rehearing on that issue and show evidence of what the price of gas was in what your theory was, the area or the field?
Your Honor, when we learned for the first time in the decision,
is the answer to my question no?
No, the answer is yes. Yes, we did ask for reconsideration.
Did you put in more evidence?
We only had 60 days, and so what we put in was our assertion that we believed that there were other parties in the area who sold gas in a condition that was different than the condition Interior said had to be marketable condition here.
Wasn't that your obligation to put that evidence in?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is. It's Interior's position here about marketable condition has nothing to do with what purchasers require under gas sales contracts in terms of dehydration and compression. Interior's position here is that the costs we're talking about are necessary to place the gas in marketable condition only because the costs are incurred to deliver the gas to the purchaser. Okay? We said on reconsideration, you need to consider what typical gas sales contracts say in the field or area. These are our competitors. We don't have that information, but we believe there are other sales.
So is it your position, counsel, that if the Interior Department had come out with a contrary interpretation of their regulation back in the mid-90s, the same interpretation they have today, you would have had a good case arguing that that interpretation was an unreasonable interpretation of the regulation?
Yes, Your Honor, we would.
Do you think so?
Yes, because the
market... Your primary argument was that the agency had put a different interpretation, the Royalty Board had, and therefore they were stuck under Alaska hunters.
I think that's an equally strong position. Well, but
I love it when everybody's got equal
but,
strong
but our position. But our first position is the marketable condition.
Let me ask a question about that second point. Who the devil is the Royalty Board? We've been trying to figure that out. All the clerks have been looking, trying to find out who the Royalty Board was. Royalty Board is a different organization. The Royalty Board was, and all I could get out of your brief is that one person from the solicitor's office was there, not the solicitor. And they weren't political appointees. That was the assistant secretary who gave you the contrary ruling.
That's correct. There is information on the website. The Royalty Policy Board is set up by the Minerals Management Service, which is a sub-agency of the Interior Department, and the head of the Royalty Policy Board is the deputy director of the Minerals Management Service.
Pretty low-ranking person, isn't it?
No, Your Honor.
Wait, let's get the point. I want to get to the point on this. We went through your materials pretty carefully. You're not suggesting, and you certainly aren't supporting it in any way, that the Royalty Board had the authority to issue a binding regulation. That is, to issue something that had the force of law, right?
That is correct.
Okay. You're not suggesting that what was issued had the force of law, right?
That is correct.
Okay. So I don't see how you have a case. And let me tell you, you all have argued about cases that to me seem perfectly inapposite. Alaska doesn't, there was an informal adjudication in that case. And that established the policy. Once an agency does that, they have an adjudication and they make a determination that has the force of law because the agency is action. You all have been fighting over cases that have nothing to do with anything as far as I can figure out. There's a whole line of cases in this circuit. For example, Center for Auto Safety, 2006, 452, Fed 3rd, 798, where we said merely because regulated parties follow advice that has been given by someone who does not have the authority to promulgate an agency regulation is a practical result, it does not have the force of law. So the only fight left for you is whether or not, as you first argued, the plain language of the regulation controls this case, because I don't see how you make out a case otherwise.
Your Honor, I guess I would disagree on Alaska Hunters. There was an adjudication in that case, but that adjudication wasn't by the agency that was giving the advice, the FAA employees in Alaska who were giving the advice about what the regulations meant.
Were they giving the advice based on the adjudication?
Well, the adjudication was by a different agency.
Doesn't matter. It was based on the adjudication. But in any event, there is a line of authority that is on the point about. And look at Center for Auto Safety, which goes back in all of our case law. And it's based on the Bennett case from the Supreme Court. It's the final action cases, but it's directly on point because it determines whether or not something has the force of law. And that's really the argument you're trying to make, because you concede that the guidelines and advisories alone did not have the force of law, nor were they issued by anyone who had the authority to give them the force of law. And these cases that I'm pointing to you say mere adherence to those advisories doesn't make it different. The situation's still the same. The regulation is what determines the case.
Your Honor, we do have additional facts here. I mean, it's not just an advisory that was issued that wasn't binding
that we followed.
And
there was a Dear Party letter as well.
There was a decision by the Royalty Policy Board.
And you agree that they don't have the authority to issue anything that has the force of law?
About what the interpretation meant.
Right.
That was followed by three separate publicly disseminated.
Look at Center for Auto Safety. It went on and on and on. And the regulator parties came in and said, well, but they were saying this. And there are other cases in that same line of authority, and we said it doesn't matter. The fact that you followed that didn't make it so.
But it wasn't just us that followed it. It was the department employees also.
Same thing
also
in Center for Auto Safety. It was the whole regulated industry followed it. And we said that doesn't make it so. That's a practical, not a legal consequence.
Well,
these cases go back to paralyzed veterans, where both Judge Edwards and I sat. And we pointed out that just speeches weren't sufficient to, even when they sounded very authoritative, weren't sufficient to constitute a binding interpretation of a regulation, particularly by subordinate officials.
That's correct, Your Honor, but we have a decision by the Royalty Board. We have three announcements by, not the Secretary, certainly, but Minerals Management Service officials who were responsible for administering the royalty program.
Well, it was also clear. Why did you ask for evaluation?
There were a lot of issues surrounding coalbed methane valuation.
I mean, that just leaps out
of
the case.
Not
it
just
fits
that
so perfectly when you read the case and you say, whoops.
There were lots.
I mean, if this is so clear, you say the regulation is plain in your favor and the guidances are plain in your favor, and I'm saying, well, why did they ask for information?
On that particular issue, it was very clear, but there were a number of other issues in coalbed methane valuation, which was why they asked for the value determination.
Okay.
If I may, could I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal? Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Sam Sankar for the United States, and with me at council table is Matt McCowan, the Associate Solicitor for Interior in charge of mineral resources. The government, as you were aware in this case, leases land to Devon in return for a percentage of the gross proceeds that result from those sales. Devon is trying to interpret the regulations that define how gross proceeds should be calculated in a way that's favorable to them and in a way that reduces their royalty payments. Devon's interpretation of the regulations really ignores the regulations themselves. What Devon is trying to say here is that any compression costs incurred after the point the gas is taken out of its wells are a shared responsibility of the federal government and the lessees. The cases, both from the Interior Department and from this court itself, uniformly hold the opposite. In fact, the preamble to the marketable condition rule says quite explicitly that costs such as those for compression to meet pipeline pressure requirements to place the gas in marketable condition should be borne by the lessee. So Devon's interpretation is quite contradictory to what the regulations themselves say. In addition, to speak briefly to Devon's argument that the various letters that were sent out in 1995 and 1996 somehow establish a contrary interpretation, in addition to all of the points that Judge Edwards has already noted, the letters themselves, the government contends, don't support the interpretation that Devon is trying to put forward before this court. If you look most clearly at Joint Appendix at page 160, the compression guidance letter itself says that compression costs incurred to put the gas in the condition necessary for the pipeline immediately downstream are to be borne by the lessor.
Now, let me ask you a question, counsel, about your regulation. There's no question that your regulation allows transportation costs to be deducted, right?
That's right.
On page 21 of your
page
brief,
21 of our brief.
Your brief, you say, as Interior explained, simply because compression may be necessary to make gas transportable does not mean that compression is a cost of transportation.
That's right.
I don't understand. It sounds like gobbledygook to me.
This is a difficult area of law, and it took me some time to figure this out as well. I think you got to the point earlier when you said that sometimes compression is necessary for both purposes. You can't sell natural gas at the 3 or 4 or 5 PSI it comes out from the wellheads. In addition, you can't transport it in that way either. Interior has interpreted these two things to mean that you initially have to get the gas to the pressure necessary to get it into the pipeline where it goes to the purchaser. Any compression costs after that point, and there were some in this case.
Suppose you could have sold it right at the wellhead without compression.
You'd have to show that was typical for the area, and I only know of one case in which that happened. That's the Zeno case.
If you could show that.
There's a limit on that, and that is...
Wait a minute. What would Interior's position be then?
It would depend on if those sales were typical for the area.
I'm saying, is that they were typical for the area?
That is to say that everyone in the area was selling gas.
Well, typical doesn't mean everyone.
Fair enough. If the lessor could show that the gas was ready for market, and in some cases gas comes out of wells at a very high pressure, and in those cases it would be yes.
Or maybe the consumer can use it at low pressure.
That's right. If you look at the Zeno case, XENO, that's referred to, that is such a situation in which the gas was coming out at 300 PSI, and so Interior allowed further compression costs after that, even though those were the only compression costs that were undertaken.
Because
it was only for transportation, and the lessor showed that.
Well, but this statement, simply because compression may be necessary to make gas transportable, does not mean that compression is a cost of transportation. It's a funny statement, isn't it?
To the extent that there's any inclarity in that.
It's like saying simply because you have to put it on a railroad doesn't mean it's a cost of transportation.
It's not absolutely clear, but I want to refer the court. To the extent that there's any confusion on this, I want to refer the court to 30 CFR 206.157F9, and this is referred to in our brief, and I'm going to quote from that regulation. It says that compression costs are only allowable as transportation costs if such services are required for transportation, number one, and exceed the services necessary to place production into marketable condition. So to the extent there's any wiggle in that statement, it's clarified in the regulations, and I think that Interior was on firm ground here.
Fair point.
If there are no further questions, Your Honor, we just ask that this court affirm Interior's judgment below that it
needs. Tell me who the royalty board is.
Mystery. Your Honor, it's a bit of a mystery as well to me. I think the dispositive point is the one that Judge Edwards extracted a concession from counsel for.
That may be a dispositive point, but I want to know who the devil the royalty board is. There's briefs fighting back and forth about it. We
desperately try to figure out who the royalty board is.
No, they don't have authority, but who are they?
Your
Honor, I got to tell you, I just don't know. I know the dispositive fact for this litigation. Their statements are not binding on the agency, and to the extent there's any binding in the statement, it's any binding statement in this litigation, it's only the one that decided this case. And I'm sorry, if the court really wants us to get to the bottom of this, I'm happy to submit a letter.
I think it's more funny than anything else.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's no further questions.
Ms. Your Honor, you may have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I'm going to try one more time here. Interior's counsel says that our position is that any time gas is compressed after it comes out of the ground, the government has to share that cost. That is not our position. We agree that if a purchaser under a gas sales contract requires the gas to be compressed or dehydrated as a condition of that gas sales contract, then that is necessary to place the gas in marketable condition, necessary to market the gas. We agree that that is not deductible from royalty purposes.
That sounds like a distinction without a difference. If I'm the purchaser of the gas, if I write in the contract that you have to dehydrate and compress in order to ship it to me, then you recognize that that's marketable condition.
Correct.
But if I say you have to ship it to me, and everybody knows you have to compress and dehydrate to ship it, and please do that, then it's not marketable condition because I didn't put it in the contract?
Unless it's both. Okay, pipeline.
No, I think what you said is if I don't put it in the contract, I simply say I want it delivered, and of course you know you can't deliver it without compressing and dehydrate, so I assume that you'll do what you need to do, then it's not deductible.
What we say is that the cost
counsel,
of delivering
the question is it's not deductible unless it's in the contract. Even if it's understood at the time I buy it, you're going to have to dehydrate and compress in order to ship it to me.
That's
that
correct.
That's a thin distinction.
But that's the same thing is true for any transportation expense. And the regulations clearly do allow transportation expenses. The cost to get the gas delivered to the purchaser is a transportation expense. The cost to make the gas, condition the gas so that it's acceptable to the purchaser is a marketable condition expense. So, for example, you can have a pipeline that says, I'm not going to transport this gas to the Buckshot plant unless you dehydrate it and compress it to get it there. We say that's a transportation expense. If the purchaser is down in the Cheyenne hub, a couple hundreds of miles away, don't have any requirements for their pipeline about compression or dehydration, we say there's no overlap between the transportation allowance regulations and the marketable condition rule. Marketable condition rule defines marketable condition as the condition required to be for gas to be accepted by a purchaser under a gas sales contract that's typical for a field or area. It doesn't say the condition gas has to be in to be delivered to the purchaser. It doesn't say the condition required by a transportation contract. It says sales contract required by a purchaser. The cost to deliver the gas to the purchaser is a different issue. That's covered by the transportation allowance regulations.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.